Hello, I'm Barry Daniel, and this is the podcast of the Middle Way Society. Our aim is to encourage a universal approach to living a more integrated, ethical life, avoiding dogma or any absolute appeal to authority. Just briefly before we start the interview, I'd like to flag that there's still time to book for our virtual Festival of the Middle Way, which will be held on the 18th and 19th of April. There are 20 events to choose from in 17 time slots, including talks with interactive discussion by Ian McGilchrist, Stephen Batchelor, Marina Cantacuzino, and others, and workshops in integrative practices led by experienced teachers. Stephen's keynote talk is entitled Embracing Extinction, Buddhism, the Middle Way, and the Climate Emergency. Due to the unprecedented circumstances we find ourselves in and the economic impact many people are experiencing, the £15 cost is now being treated as an optional donation. So just check out our website, www.middlewaysociety.org, for more information about the event and if you're interested, how you'd sign up. Our guest today is a patron of the Society, author, Buddhist scholar and teacher Stephen Batchelor, who's here to talk to us about his latest book, The Art of Solitude. Hello, Stephen. Welcome back to the Middle Way Society podcast.
Oh, hello, Barry. It's lovely to be on it again.
Okay, well, your title suggests, The Art of Solitude, that solitude is a skill to cultivate.
That's correct, yes. I think of solitude not so much as a sort of a descriptive state of being alone, which is rather self-evident, but actually as something you cultivate. And I put it a little bit more strongly than that. I think solitude is a practice. It's something you have to practice, something you learn how to do. Clearly, everybody knows what it's like to be alone. We spend time physically isolated from others, and so on. But the real solitude is not our physical isolation. Our real solitude is our capacity to be alone with ourselves and to be at ease with that. And to cultivate, as it were, an inner space of stability, an inner space of lucidity, which brings it very close, actually, to the practice of meditation.
You say the book explores the middle ground of solitude.
Well, I think when you look at the literature around the topic of solitude, and it is very extensive, you find that it tends to veer between the negative side of solitude, which is what we would call loneliness or isolation or alienation, which is quite prominent in our culture, to think of solitude as a somewhat undesirable condition to be in. But then on the other hand, we find poets and artists and writers and others thinking of solitude very much as a desirable condition to have, a space where you can have peace, where you can be alone, where you can reflect more deeply, where you might even find the capacity to activate your imagination. Some poets, some mystics speak of solitude as a kind of rapture or bliss. So the concept of solitude is one that's very fluid in a way. It extends from some of our darkest and most painful human experiences to others which we would consider to be almost the highest points of what human experience is capable of achieving. Now, in my book, I'm not so interested in those extreme conditions of solitude, but rather to think of solitude more broadly as simply the space we have within ourselves that can allow us to be more fully who we are, can allow us to think more clearly, can allow us also, I feel, a kind of ethical intelligence to emerge, one in which we're less preoccupied with the thoughts and the fears and the emotions that so often assail us. Inner solitude, or what Montaigne calls true solitude, is not being separate from all of the busyness of the world and the noise and rush of cities, but it's to find a way to be alone, to be still within ourselves, in which the rush and the chatter of our minds begin to quieten down, and we find this aloneness as a state of stillness, of clarity within us. And there, I think, we actually find the roots of much of our human activity that we consider to be not only valuable, but that enables us really to flourish as persons. That is done, I think, to a large degree by carving out this space of solitude within.
I'm curious how you structured the book.
A bit of a long story. I mentioned in the preamble to the book that the whole text was organized according to the principles I used to make collages. And so I think it's fair to think of the book as an attempt at a kind of literary collage. Now, the way I make collages is that I gather materials that I find lying around on my various travels and journeys, or even when I'm at home. I collect things that people have discarded, bits of paper, plastic, cloth, anything that I can stick onto cardstock. But then I organize these randomly found materials into highly organized mosaics of about 48 centimeters square, usually, and in which I subject these materials to inclusion within a gridwork structure that is preconceived beforehand. And what I've done with this book is somewhat similar. I've designed the book according to a series of four poems that might, in fact, be some of the very earliest materials that make up the Pali Canon, the earliest texts in the Buddhist tradition. And these four eights, as I call them, these four eight-verse poems, make up a total of 32 verses. Each poem has 32 lines. And I've taken that number, somewhat arbitrarily, as the kind of framework for organizing the material in the book. So there are 32 chapters. And amongst those 32 chapters, there are four essays, one on solitude and art, one on philosophy, one on medicine, and one on contemplation. And each of those eight-part essays is then, by chance operations, in other words, just a way of randomly mixing up these four eight-section essays in such a way that they all get sort of mixed up together. And so you never know when you're reading a particular chapter what theme will come in the chapter that follows, nor will you have been able to simply build in that particular chapter what you've already introduced in the chapter before. It requires that each chapter, which is roughly around 1,000 words, stands on its own, in its own solitude, as it were, and that the connection between the different pieces is achieved not by a linear continuity of ideas, although there is to some degree that those threads running through the book, but largely treating each little chapter as a kind of standalone piece that can reflect and bounce off the standalone pieces that surround it. And that's exactly how, in my visual aesthetic, the collage works function. So I know it's a little bit idiosyncratic to construct a book this way, but ever since I started doing collages, which is about 25 years ago now, I've always seen them as a kind of counterpoint to my written work. Each of my books is accompanied, although it's not declared and I never show these works, by a process of collage making. And in The Art of Solitude, I decided for the first time to bring these two disciplines together and to treat the words that I find, as it were, that come to mind, or I read in a book, or I overhear on a radio interview, or whatever it is. Those found materials of ideas now, of words and sentences and paragraphs and so on, get the same treatment as my bits of paper and plastic and cloth. And it's a bit of a risk doing this, I realize, but to be honest, I'm actually quite happy with the result.
Well, I found it a delight, actually, because you never knew what was coming next. There was something really attractive about that. To me, it was a wonderful pastiche of profound personal experiences, which with at times quite painful honesty and some really interesting sources of inspiration. It also feels, having read quite a few of your books, Stephen, like a change of tack in some ways from your previous work. Is this a one-off, or do you feel you might have gone in a different direction in some way?
I don't think it's a one-off, but it is certainly a change in tack. And arguably, it's my first non-Buddhist book. Everything I've written up until now has been essentially an attempt to argue for a particular interpretation of Buddhism, what I call a secular dharma. And in that sense, the books have had a sort of a polemical intent, and there are ways of furthering an argument. I'm not interested in doing that with this book. I'm interested not in telling the reader what I think and what I believe to be the case. I'm interested in showing the reader what solitude looks like from the point of view of those who practice it. And as you must have noticed, the amount of Buddhist material is relatively small. Probably way more than half the book concerns themes like the philosophy of Montaigne and the experimentation with ayahuasca and so on, which has got nothing whatsoever to do with Buddhism. It's true, of course, that I cannot simply forsake my past and pretend that I don't have any interest in these things. And of course, that will come through. So I'm not trying to suppress or hide my interest in Buddhism and my involvement in Buddhism, but I'm no longer really interested anymore in trying to persuade people that my version of Buddhism is somehow viable or maybe even an improvement on the traditional one. So I've left that behind. And this book is certainly not a one-off. It's quite explicitly, not explicitly in the book, but in my own mind, it's part of a dyad. I'm now going to write a book called The Art of Care. And this will be structured along the same broad collage principles. It will also have 32 chapters. And I'm actually already working on the outline of this. And this has been the project all along, is to produce two books, one on solitude, one on care, which harken back, as you might recognize, to my very first publication in 1983, a book called Alone with Others. What I'm doing here is I'm sort of revisiting my own past, and yet I'm now trying, as it were, to engage this paradox that humans have of being simultaneously alone, you know, in the privacy of our own thoughts and so on, and simultaneously socially embedded, participants in a shared reality with others. And that this has always been a core concern and koan of mine, really. And this book, The Art of Solitude, is half of a bigger project, which in a few years down the line will have a companion volume, I hope, called The Art of Care, which will talk not about solitude, but about participation in society.
Okay, well, I look forward to that, Stephen. What might be interesting now is to actually to explore those two themes that feature quite prominently in the book. First of all, the work and life of the French philosopher Michel de Montaigne is suffused through the book. And he seems to have had a profound influence on you in many ways. What is it about his work that you find so resonant and helpful?
There are many things that I find resonant and helpful in Montaigne. I just find the very way in which he writes, the way he constructs his essays, is inspirational. The way he, as it were, as he says, my mind and my pen roam all over the place. There's a kind of chaotic dimension to his writing that's very liberating, I find. And he admits himself that he's actually struggling to find another kind of language. And that too is something that I've been working on ever since I began writing, is to try to find a language that can articulate the concerns that move me most deeply, in this case, I guess, my Buddhist background. So again, we have a commonality there. We're trying to articulate something that matters to us, but we're frustrated with the limitations of the formal writing context that we are provided with in our culture. But I think one of the things that really gets to me about Montaigne is his a commitment to skeptical philosophy. And he admits himself that he is largely inspired by the Pironian kind of skepticism that runs right through his thinking, but he's also sufficiently open to non-skeptical kinds of Greek thought, Epicureanism, Stoicism, the example of Socrates and others, that grounds his thinking very much in a philosophical tradition that is not remotely abstract philosophy. Montaigne is very, very clear that he's following the example of these Hellenistic philosophers primarily, who see philosophy as a way of life. They see philosophy as something you do. They see philosophy as a way you actually change yourself. And you, I mean, the practice of solitude, in a sense, is a philosophical practice. It's a practical philosophy. Yeah. So that, again, I find enormous resonance with that. And I also am inspired by his life. I'm inspired by the fact that this is a man who retreats from the busyness of the world to his tower, and he works on these ideas, and he spends, you know, huge amounts of time just studying his own mind. And yet at the same time, as again comes clear in the book, he never really ceases to be an active participant in his world, the world of the wars of religion in France, his role as a diplomat, negotiating between different elements in this conflict. And that, too, I find inspiring. So Montaigne is a fully rounded Renaissance man, almost literally, really, that I feel to be both a kindred spirit and also someone, I think, who serves as a very powerful example of a life of great authenticity, integrity and honesty.
Okay, the book is also an exploration of your experience with psychedelic substances, initially with peyote and later with ayahuasca. At one point, having taken peyote, you ask one of the facilitators the question, if peyote is the medicine, then what is the sickness it cures? I wonder if we could just explore that. Maybe explore why you are drawn to these substances and what was his answer.
Well, as I say in the outset of the book, when I was 60, which is now 6 years ago, I took a sabbatical. And I wanted to spend that year really taking stock of my life. I wanted to go back to some of the formative experiences that had led me to the Dharma, to Buddhism, back when I was still a teenager. And I wanted to explore also the intersections with my writing and my art by looking at particular artists or particular works of art. I wanted to bring the art, the philosophy, the contemplation together. And amongst that mix, I wanted to include a revisiting of my earlier experiences as a young man with LSD and things like this, which I do think were very instrumental in turning my mind towards the Buddhist tradition. Or maybe, let's say, more instrumental in turning my life, in turning me towards a light of greater self-awareness and inwardness. Perhaps I could put it that way. So rather than simply taking a pill in my living room and seeing what happened, which is what I used to do, I was also quite drawn to the idea of taking these plant medicines in a ceremonial context under the guidance of a shaman and in a group, which is very different to anything I'd ever done before. And this has been interesting me for many years. These are what I recount in the book are the first experiences I've ever had with either of these things. But I had, through friends and through reading over the years, become more and more curious about how these psychedelic substances would affect me now. I'm not the same as I was when I was 19. I like to think that 40 years of meditating and thinking and writing might actually have made a difference to the kind of person I am. And one way to sort of get a sense of that would be to actually, you know, put myself in these situations where under peyote and ayahuasca, a lot of one's conventional habitual thinking is suspended and one encounters a non-ordinary state of consciousness, which at its best, I think, affords one an opportunity to look quite deeply into what is going on with oneself. So I arranged with a friend in Mexico to be part of a ceremony there with a shaman. And then a couple of years later, I did a ceremony with ayahuasca, but this was in Europe. And then a year or so after that, another one. And those are recounted in the book. And I'm not in any way offering, you know, suggesting that everybody should do these things. I think it's very much to do with one's own personal history and need and so forth and so on. But nonetheless, I found that these experiences were actually very, very insightful, very rewarding. And they did somehow nudge my life onto a somewhat different vector, one might say. I found particularly with the, well, with the peyote, I found an enormous sense of self-validation, a sense of confirmation, a sense also of a kind of purification or cleansing that stayed with me for a very long time, long after the actual effect of the alkaloids on my neurotransmitters had worn off. And likewise with the ayahuasca. With the ayahuasca, I felt very much a kind of a purging. And that is, in fact, what ayahuasca is often called, la purga in Spanish. Mm-hmm. And although it involves actual purging, in other words, you vomit quite a lot, I found that in my own case, that vomiting was not just simply my physical reaction to some rather foul-tasting stuff, but actually it seemed to have a psycho-spiritual corollary in freeing me of certain addictive behaviors. On the first ceremony, it completely dispelled any interest in ever drinking wine or beer or alcohol ever again, and I've not touched a drop since then, which is now 3.5 years ago. From being someone who would drink, reasonable, not a great amount, but I would drink wine every evening and so on. It became a habit, and I think I did have a somewhat addictive relationship to it. But in the second ayahuasca experience, what I managed to vomit up there was, I think, perhaps even deeper attachment, and that is my attachment to Buddhism. And in those both those regards, as well as with the experience with peyote, I feel somehow I've been somehow cleansed of something. My eyes have been open to see myself and my world from a somewhat different perspective. And I feel that these experiences have been overwhelmingly positive. At the moment, I have no interest at all in taking them again. I think they may have done their work. But again, I wouldn't rule out at some later point that I might have participate in yet another ceremony. But I feel the book provided me with a 5-year sort of window to explore and to experiment in these areas. And that's effectively what I've recorded. And I feel that it has been largely a very positive experience.
Great. It reminded me quite a bit of my own experience as well, Stephen. I took LSD several times in my early 20s, probably about the same time as you when I was about 20, 21. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if it changed my core values to any great extent, but similar to what you just said then, I wonder if it played a part in me trying to be more open-minded. You never know what tack your life would have taken if you hadn't taken these substances, but I can't help thinking I went on a different vector. Yeah. as you said then. It seems to be something in the air as well, because I was planning to go this year to Holland to actually take psilocybin, which is the active psychoactive element in magic mushrooms, but under a controlled situation in a kind of retreat like setting. But that's unfortunately been cancelled at the moment because of the coronavirus at the moment. But like you, I'm 60 this year, and it's this idea of perhaps taking stock to some extent, mm-hmm, of my life, how I stand now.
I think our society doesn't really provide us frameworks, particularly our secular society, doesn't really provide us many ritualized frameworks in which we can pursue these sorts of stock-taking exercises. This might be one of them. I think we do have to be careful in not treating these, and I like to call them plant medicines. I try to avoid the drug language altogether. I don't think it's very, it's such a, so much baggage comes with that word. I frame this entire part of the book in the language of medication, of self-medication. But one thing I think also came very clear to me during these ceremonies is that the alkaloids themselves of the medicines and the way they interact with your neurotransmitters is only one of many factors that contribute to the overall experience. In the 60s, when this stuff was being explored by Timothy Leary and Richard Alpert and others, they were very aware of the fact that what they call the set and the setting. The set is the intention you have taken, to be very, very clear about the intention. And in all of these ceremonies, they start with the group sharing their intentions and making it clear to themselves and to the others why they're doing this. The other thing is the setting itself. In other words, the silence and the and doing it overnight with the peyote, with an open fire, with the ayahuasca, with candlelit rooms in a, and so on, keeping silence. And then afterwards also processing the experience together with the ayahuasca. This usually involved drawing and painting and having a little sort of therapeutic exercise afterwards. And I think all of those things together contribute to the experience. And we must be careful not to think of it materialistically and reductively as simply the effect of a drug on your brain. That's, I think, not a very helpful way of looking at it.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, brilliant. Another field of human experience that formed a large part of the book was art in relation to solitude. Yeah. And in particular, the work of Vermeer, which is an artist you seem particularly fascinated in.
Well, art is a very important part of my life, and it may not come so clearly through my writing, it's an area, again, I wanted to this book to somehow allow the possibility of my exploring my interest in art with my interest in philosophy and contemplation and other things as well. I wanted somehow to create a book that would be a much more integrated expression of what, you know, I most deeply value in this life. And I enjoy art in two ways. First, as an enjoyer of art, as someone who loves going to art galleries and admiring the particular works that are on display. And again, I've got a very wide range of artists and works that I like, from the medieval art I love all the way through to some of the contemporary works that's being produced today. But also, I'm a practicing artist, and the practice of art for me is very close to the practice of meditation, or the practice of Dharma. So I see it from both perspectives. And in the book, I likewise look at it from these two dimensions. The artist whose work I reflect on in the book is Johannes Vermeer, a 17th century Dutch genre painter, as he's normally called, but particularly a series of pieces of paintings that he produced, where you just have a single young woman, usually, in a domestic situation, performing a very ordinary task, pouring milk from a jug, or balancing something on some scales, or trying on a necklace, or writing a letter, or playing a musical instrument. And these paintings have always struck me as somehow highly skilled in communicating what it's like to be, what human experience is like from the inside. That's the best I can say. I can't think of any other artist who is able with, and it's extraordinary, it's just brush strokes on a piece of canvas in the end, but who's able to create the illusion through his skills of the very core inwardness of human experience. And I think no one does this to the degree that Vermeer does. Now, I'm not the first person to observe that Vermeer is the great artist of solitude and so on, but they've really spoken to me as a contemplative and also as a practitioner of the arts. And the other side of it, which includes particularly the work of the American abstract painter Agnes Martin, I'm interested in how solitude is also the framework within which art is created. And Agnes Martin said at one point that she paints with her back to the world. And this is mirrored very much in what is some people consider to be the most accomplished of Vermeer's paintings, which is called The Art of Painting. And it's an allegorical painting about painting. And again, when you look at the painting, you look at a painter seated on a stool with his back to you. And I feel that this conveys the idea that art is a practice of solitude, that you go to your studio or wherever you work, and you effectively remove yourself from the demands of your everyday existence, and you find yourself utterly alone with your work. And this is, of course, true with writers and poets and painters and sculptors. Anybody who embarks on a life of creative expression is very much choosing a life of solitude. And so this struck me, these two dimensions of appreciating art, particularly the art of Vermeer that shows us solitude, I think, in a way that has never been bettered, and also through Agnes Martin and also some of Vermeer's work, how the production of art is likewise emerges out of our capacity to be alone.
Okay, you also touch on the experience of hermits, and there's a story of a contemporary person who went to an island to seek deep solitude. Yeah. And what I found fascinating there was at one point he recognised that solitude is arguably only meaningful within the context of being part of and at some point returning to a community. I think you made the point at one point in the chapter, you know, if there'd been an Armageddon, there was no one else alive, then his solitude wouldn't have the same, it would be a lot harder to hold in many ways.
Yeah, this is a fellow called Robert Carl, or Bob Carl, and this is one of the episodes came around by chance. Again, chance operations, found materials. I was writing the book, and then I got a package out of the blue from my publisher in America. And inside this package was a book called Solitude, Searching Wisdom in Extremes by Robert Carl. Now, he had sent it to me because he'd read After Buddhism and wanted to express his appreciation. So he sent me a copy of his book. And so it came about purely by chance. And I knew then that I had to follow that lead. And so I read his book, and I got in touch with him. We've actually corresponded quite a lot. And I think he makes a wonderful contribution to this book, because he's not particularly well known. But he did do something that I found really quite extraordinary, and that is to go off to the tip of Patagonia in South America and plonk himself on this tiny little island. It is miles from anywhere, and lived there for a year, all by himself. And his journal basically is an account of that year. But as you point out, he, like many other solitaries, have come to this understanding of the paradox of solitude. The paradox of solitude is the fact that, I think as Montaigne says somewhere, actually, he says, I can arrive at the most brilliant insights in my solitude, but if there's no one else with whom I can share them, then they're meaningless. And that's...
Yeah, he says, no happy thought occurs to me without me being irritated at bringing it forth alone with no one to offer it up to.
Exactly. You find that refrain in many, many of those who have consciously given themselves to solitude. You find it in Shantideva, the 8th century Indian Buddhist monk who retreats into the mountains to meditate. And then as soon as he starts meditating, he realizes how totally he is embedded in the collective life of humanity, or in fact of all sentient beings in his case. And so there is a paradox here. It's the paradox that I'm aware of with this notion of alone with others. It's the same old thing, that these two poles of our experience only appear to be binaries and opposites until we actually, you know, go deeper into either of them and discover that they're more or less inseparable. You can't really have one without the other. They constitute our humanity at some level. And rather than think of two, I mean, in middle way type languages, we tend to absolutize either. And we absolutize solitude as being totally alone. We absolutize participation as, you know, being completely and utterly engaged in the world and social affairs and relationships and so on. Whereas the reality is that these two poles are really only poles within a spectrum. And most of the time we live somewhere in the middle between the two. That would be the middle way approach, I think. That we are, you know, simultaneously alone with others. That is the core paradox. And I think Robert Cull discovers that towards the end of his stay on his island, as do many others, as a quotation from Nelson Mandela too, who likewise was forced into solitude. But he said it was only through the silence and the solitude that I could really appreciate the power of language and the effect it has on how people live and die. It's very, very much the refrain.
Yeah. Okay. And just coming on to the middle way, and as you say in the book, you touch on Buddhism, but it's certainly not the main theme in any sense of the book. But there's a lovely passage when the Buddha remembers an experience as a child of solitude, which arguably leads him to the middle way.
Yes, it's the episode to which you're referring is one that is it follows, at least in the legend, as well as we can reconstruct it. Gautama leaves home and he then studies with various teachers and he gets into deep states of meditation and then he gets involved in all these kind of extreme ascetic practices. Now, all of that, whether it happened or not, is basically a way of saying how he explored all of the options that were open to him as means to somehow come to a resolution of his most fundamental questions of what it meant to be human. And neither of these approaches work. Becoming a student of a guru, subjecting himself to all kinds of ascetic sufferings and so on, and neither of them work. And he then finds himself basically in a condition of crisis. He's exhausted all possibilities. He's still left with the same fundamental questions. And then he remembers an experience he had as a child. Again, we don't know whether he's 6 or whether he's 16. I would guess probably in his early teens at some point. And he describes sitting beneath a rose apple tree while his father is busy at work, so presumably in the fields around where they would have lived. And then he quite spontaneously fell into a state of contemplative rapture, basically, which he said was born from solitude, born from viveka, from solitude. And it's this experience that suddenly he found a way of being alone with himself that was devoid of any sensory inputs from outside and was also not at all influenced by any kind of theories or thoughts he might have had, but was a purely self-contained state of, self-sufficiency, I suppose. And well-being and rest and calm. And he said, what's wrong with this well-being, this kind of rapture that I experience now? Maybe that is the way to resolve these questions. And it's from there that he then proceeds to follow his inquiry, supposedly beneath the Bodhi tree, and reach awakening. So, in traditional Buddhist jargon, this is called the first jhana, the first absorption. There are four such absorptions. And so it in a sense, was the discovery, in a way through his own story as a young man, to enter into the states of meditation that open up the possibilities of a resolution to his quest. So that is, again, I feel, from the Buddhist point of view, a rather important dimension of the role of solitude in the awakening of the Buddha.
Great, Stephen. OK, my last question. I just thought I'd just say that the date today is March the 16th, and we're facing this situation with the coronavirus, where potentially millions of people will have to be putting themselves into self-isolation for, they've been talking about in the UK, potentially for the people who are particularly vulnerable, for several months. What advice would you, in a very general sense, would you give to people about cultivating a practice of solitude? I'm sure many people who will be in this situation will have had no experience of meditation or whatever. I was just wondering, in broad terms, what advice or any thoughts you could give.
Well, I'm glad you brought up the reality of the coronavirus. I'm here in France at the moment under lockdown. I'm also very close to, I'm in 67, I think. I'm 67 next month. But basically, I'm in a high risk zone, high risk age range. Very likely, we're going to have to learn how to be alone a lot better. And for in our society, unless you happen to have an interest in meditation already, you're going to be rather unprepared for this. And I feel that the book, The Art of Solitude, might at least give one some consolation, perhaps, some clues as to what you may undertake in order to not feel oppressed and lonely in your solitude, but actually to take this enforced isolation as an opportunity rather than some sort of a narrowing or a reduction of your life. And meditation would clearly come to mind, but I think also people need to come to terms with what it's like to be with themselves. That may not always be resolved by learning how to meditate. It may be that they will be drawn to a certain kind of reflections. Maybe they'll turn back to things like poetry and art and literature, maybe reading more spiritual or religious texts as a way to deepen a kind of contemplation as to what it means to be human. The very fact that we are put in this isolation because of a real existential threat, we may die. I have no way of knowing that. I might even be a carrier. I've been traveling from Los Angeles to Paris just a couple of days ago. Who knows? We have to take into account that we're dealing here with matters of life and death. And that, I would suggest, can be, again, a very deepening, a very enriching reflection. If we have the capacity to not be freaked out by it or to be hopelessly, you know, driven towards some kind of distraction, watching TV all day or whatever. So, yes, that would be my hope, that this coronavirus crisis could actually be turned to deeper forms of reflection, of meditation, of making art, of appreciating art. And learning how to be alone in a society that really gives little value to that experience. This will provide us, hopefully, with a great opportunity. And curiously, I've been approached the other day by the BBC World Service to be interviewed about this book in order to help people live in isolation and quarantine. So it's already, the idea is already in the air. And you may, at some point in the next few days or weeks, get more and more coming from the media once people are kind of settled in this these quarantines and isolations, that we'll start to look more deeply at how we can cope with being alone. And if I can contribute to that through this book, I'm only too happy.
Fantastic, Stephen. Well, I hope that's the case. Anyway, it's been a pleasure as always to speak to you, Stephen. Thank you very much for talking to me today.
It's a pleasure, Barry. I enjoyed our conversation and I hope others can benefit from it too.
You can find out more about Middle Way Philosophy at www.middlewaysociety.org.